Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the revelation that CNN's senior political analyst, the highly respected former White House insider David Gergen, had ties to Mitt Romney's Bain Capital while commenting on the firm to the media. Veteran financial investigative reporter William Cohan joins us. A former Wall Street banker who had dealings with Bain Capital, Cohan found Bain not to be the sterling company that David Gergen describes as having a positive reputation within the business community of Boston and beyond. Then, following the suicide bombing inside the National Security Headquarters in Damascus that killed three generals at the heart of Assad's military, and with the White House statement that it is clear that the Assad regime is losing control of Syria, a specialist on Syria, James Gilvin, joins us to examine whether these latest victories for the Free Syrian Army are a setback for the regime or a death blow. Then finally, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, Susan Shirk, joins us to discuss a front-page story in Wednesday's New York Times about how the children of China's elite, the so-called princelings, who represent the next generation of Communist Party leaders, have met at private gatherings to urge deeper political and economic change. We'll look into whether the new privileged elite will want to hold on to power or share their wealth with more of China's citizens. And joining us now is William Cohan, author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohan is a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and The Last Tycoons, A Secret History of Laissez-Faire and Company, is also another one of his bestsellers. He began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Laissez-Faire and J.P. Morgan Chase. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be here.
And there's been, of course, Mitt Romney's been very much on the defensive about charges about how long his tenure remained at Bain Capital after he said he'd left in 1999. So a lot of people have come to his defense. A group of fact checkers that the candidate Romney mentioned turn out to be actually fact checkers that work for him. But the long and the short of it is, we now learn that David Gergen, the former White House aide and CNN analyst, has just revealed that he has ties to Bain Capital while he's been reporting on the firm and defending Romney. How did that strike you?
Look, I have interviewed David Gergen once for an article that I was writing, and I've always found him to be honorable, and he seems to be quite honorable. But I have to say, upon reading this revelation, I was quite disturbed by it, because he is supposed to be, one of our leading political thinkers with huge insight into the way Washington works. And for him to be so, continuously defending Romney and Bain Capital throughout the last, 6 months, and then to have this revelation that he has, in fact, sort of been paid by Bain Capital and had been in business with Bain Capital and benefited from some of Bain Capital's private equity deals, really is something that we should have known well before this, quite frankly. So it's very disturbing to me.
And William Cohan, I've always thought that David Gergen was the epitome of the kind of sensible centrist in American politics. But if he's a closet partisan, that kind of blows the myth, doesn't it?
Well, obviously, he's been somebody who has been very close to Ronald Reagan, worked in the Reagan administration. But you're right, he worked, I believe, also in the Carter administration.
And the Clinton administration.
So, he was always sort of one of these wise men that we all look to for, exactly as you said, Ian, for sort of centrist views or sort of apolitical views, just telling people how it is really in Washington. And as a result, I think he was one who provided an incredibly invaluable service to the rest of us, who obviously have no idea how things really work in Washington. And, again, to find out that he is at least partisan on the issue of Bain Capital and Romney is disturbing, and frankly bursts a little bit of the bubble that I put David Gergen in. I mean, I put him on by a pedestal maybe higher than he should have been put on, but I guess this brings it back down to earth somewhat.
Again, I'm speaking with William Cohen, author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohen is a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. And we're talking about one of Mitt Romney's defenders, and particularly in terms of Bain Capital, David Gergen, who is a CNN analyst, former White House aide, who has apparently been, to some extent, on the Bain Capital payroll. Apparently, he lives in Boston, David Gergen, and he says that Bain Capital has a very good reputation. They are not seen as corporate raiders. They are seen as responsible in the way they buy out things. And refuting critics of Romney and his rivals, he says that Bain Capital is a success within the free market system. Now, you worked on Wall Street. When you worked on Wall Street, you did deals with Bain Capital. So when Gergen says that Bain Capital has a stellar reputation inside Boston, and I take it that that's not entirely gels with your experience dealing with Bain Capital on Wall Street.
Right. I mean, he's obviously dealt with them in the charitable context, in the context of being hired to give speeches. He did mention that he had been involved as a beneficiary in one private equity deal, I guess because he was on the board of one of the companies that they invested in that did well. So I guess he's in a position to think charitably of them as a result of all that. I dealt with them as potential bidders of companies I was selling and representing them on the buy side when they were trying to buy certain properties. And I have to tell you, by and large, as individuals, and by the way, I never dealt with Mitt Romney directly. He was the CEO during the time when I dealt with any number of his underlings who have themselves gone on to great success and great wealth and are, of course, supporting Mitt Romney in his effort to become president. But my experience with them is that they were very, very aggressive deal doers, which I suppose, and what do I mean by that? I mean, the example that I gave in a column I wrote for the Washington Post, you know, 2 or 3 months ago was that, I'd be selling a property and they, of course, would be wanting to buy it. And so, in that situation, there's potentially many bidders. And, of course, there's competition for them buying it. And so they were trying to eliminate the competition, which I suppose is what they're supposed to do, by trying to convince me that they were offering the highest price. And then, perhaps like a fool, I believed them. When they said they were going to offer the highest price for the company I was selling, and then they would eliminate all the competition as a result of that, and I would get them into some serious due diligence phase of the process, and then they would slowly but surely lower their price, leaving me quite embarrassed with my client and everybody wondering what the heck just happened. And as a result, there was a time after several experiences like that with Bain, I decided I would no longer include them as a potential buyer of a property I was selling. Now, who knows if they've changed since then. I found that extremely disturbing, and I found that as an example of, Bain not being particularly trustworthy, which, frankly, on Wall Street, it's hard to say this nowadays, but once upon a time, your word was your bond, and you couldn't have faith in what people told you. You couldn't have faith in the trust that they tried to imply that they had. By dealing with you on a regular basis, then what could you rely on? So I felt that, when it came to Bain Capital, they were out. I would not deal with them. And, of course, I have not seen them in any of the more charitable of frameworks and instances and experiences that David Gergen has admitted to seeing them in.
Again, I'm speaking with William Cohen, author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer at Vanity Fair and the New York Times. And he worked on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazard Frere and J.P. Morgan Chase. Now, obviously, a lot of TV pundits don't identify their affiliations. And, Dan Senor, for example, former Bush administration official, married to Campbell Brown of CNN, or formerly of CNN. He's got Wall Street ties on the Democratic side. You've got Governor Ed Rendell and ex-Congressman Harold Ford appearing regularly, not really saying what their ties are. This seems to be, a bit of a problem that we have with punditry in general, don't you think? That, they're not the independent voices that they claim to be.
Well, again, if we don't know that they are the independent voices they claim to be, I find that to be a big problem. I mean, of course, a lot of pundits who go on TV, whether it's about politics or Wall Street or other aspects. I mean, they are identified by their biases or should be when they're speaking. I think the surprising thing about this is that, you know, we, as you said, we all thought David Gergen was the epitome of the apolitical pundit who sort of told us it like it is, and was extremely insightful about the way Washington really works, given all his experience there. And so this is what's so disappointing. I mean, you know, personally, I don't have any affiliates except for the publications I write for. I no longer have ties, to Wall Street. And so, you know, I hope that when I speak, people recognize that, I'm telling them like I think it is, like I would hope that David Gergen was when he was speaking about Bain Capital. But I suppose it really does color one's view if, you know, you're getting paid by Bain Capital. It does color your views when you defend them and Mitt Romney on national television.
Well, again, Bill Cowan, Boston Globe has been doing some good reporting on this. As you know, they're the ones that revealed the discrepancy between Romney's account that he left Bain Capital in 1991 to do the Olympics in Salt Lake City. But they have come up with SEC documents saying he was actively in charge of the company through 2002. And, of course, that puts Romney in a bind. He's either been lying to the American people or lying to the SEC, which is, I think, fairly serious. And he's somewhat twisting in the wind. He still won't release his tax returns. What's your understanding about that? My understanding, he's basically dug his heels in and said, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to release any more than I have, which is only 1 year, 2010, and a partial estimate for 2011. Do you think he's going to be able to get away with that, if that's the case?
Look, the other thing that you also didn't mention and that I had written about in a Bloomberg view column this past week was how he was able to have a $102 million individual retirement account, which, of course, as I'm sure you know, one is limited to how much money one can invest to something like $30,000 a year. And, you know, in the 15 years he was at Bain, 30 times 15 is 450,000. How 450,000 becomes $102 million is a mystery that I'd also like to have some answers to. But I think that, you know, he's in a tough position. His father released 12 years of tax returns. The fact that he won't release them implies to me that he's got something to hide, and he very well may have something to hide, which is probably that there might have been some years where he didn't pay any taxes at all, even though he made a lot of money, which is obviously not something, you want to come out if you're running for president of the United States. But I think he has to come to grips with the fact that he is running for president of the United States, and we, the American people, have a right to know, not a need to know, we have a right to know, everything there is to know about our candidates and people who might be president of this country. So he should release these tax returns. He should explain the discrepancy between the time he left Bain Capital, supposedly, and what's on the SEC forms. And he should explain, once and for all, how come he has $102 million in his IRA when, you know, the math on that is just, mind-boggling. He has to be, like, the best investor in the history of IRAs to have that kind of return on the capital he invested. And, you know, at the moment, he's just being silent about it. And I think politically that is very, very damaging. If he wants to be seen as an elitist and somebody who, hides his tax information and has Cayman Island bank accounts and Swiss bank accounts. I mean, as his own Newt Gingrich said, he would be the first president of the United States to have a Swiss bank account. I mean, if this is the way he wants to run his political operation, that's his decision. But I think he's going to pay a political price for that, because I don't think the American people want to elect somebody who's president of the United States who has such a mysterious financial background.
So I spoke recently with an investigative business reporter with the Boston Globe, and she had uncovered the connection to Michael Milken in terms of Mitt Romney's first big killing when he just started at Bain Capital. His first big deal was financed by Michael Milken at a time when Milken was under investigation by the SEC, and eventually, of course, he went to jail. What I find interesting about that is that most of the big super PAC donors to Romney's campaign, Sheldon Adelson, Harold Simmons, and David Koch, all did business dealings with Michael Milken, and David Koch, of course, is on the chairman of the board of Milken's charity. Is there a sort of DNA here with these leveraged buyout guys and the connections to their being the biggest donors in terms of Romney super PACs that, you know, you don't want to be conspiratorial, but it's sort of staring you in the face?
Well, there's no question, Ian, that the world of private equity is a very tight, insular club. And especially if you got in it in the 1980s, early 1990s, when Mike Milken was, the god of private equity. I mean, you couldn't get anything financed in the early days if Mike Milken wasn't financing it. So it doesn't surprise me that Mitt Romney did a deal or did his early deals with Mike Milken being the financier. That makes all the sense in the world to me. And, you know, frankly, I wouldn't hold that against him. Of course, more disturbing is that there's all this huge amount of money that all these private equity guys have made, and now they're using that money to, because of the Citizens United ruling, which I find incredibly offensive, to endow these super PACs with huge amounts of money. And of course, who do they support? They support Mitt Romney because he's a member of the club. And you'd be very, very hard pressed to find any private equity guy on Wall Street who was not supporting Mitt Romney. I mean, it's literally, all in the family, quite frankly. I think I have a friend of mine who is a buyout guy in Chicago who supports Obama. But, I mean, that's about almost about it as far as I can tell.
Well, that wasn't the case in 2008, was it? I mean, Obama was the darling of Wall Street.
That's correct, and of course that support quickly evaporated when he started, for very good reason, in the same way that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, pointed the finger at Wall Street, and as I say, for very good reason, because there's no question, and he and I have spent years now investigating what happened to Bear Stearns, investigating what happened to Goldman Sachs, and there's no question that Wall Street, made this a self-inflicted wound and caused this crisis that did not have to happen. So, for Obama to point the finger of blame at Wall Street is very, very appropriate to me. And yet, of course, I'm very disappointed that there's been no prosecution of the people who made this happen on Wall Street. That's a whole nother issue. But then I just am astounded that so many of the people who supported him in 2008 are running in the opposite direction now because he's been slightly critical of them. There's like no self-awareness of what they caused here, and there's certainly been no accountability for what they caused. And you would think that they would at least have the ability to say, I don't like being fingered by the President of the United States, but you know what, he's absolutely right, and I'm still going to support him because I think he means well, and he wants to do the right thing, and he wants to do the right thing for all the people, and we need to dig out of this hole that Wall Street has dug us into. But they're not even willing to, admit that much, and as a result, they've all flocked to Mitt Romney and are giving him, millions and millions of dollars. And, I have a feeling that as a result, Mitt Romney is a very, very poor candidate, seems particularly tone-deaf to what's going on really in this country, and I suspect he won't be successful, but we'll know more about that in November.
Well, just in closing, William Cohan, what do you make of these hearings before the Senate Permanent Committee on Investigations, chaired by Senator Levin, co-chaired by Senator Tom Coburn? They've been looking into HSBC, a big global British bank, and it's pretty amazing, the stuff that's coming out about links to terrorism, Saudi banks that were big benefactors of Al-Qaeda, getting around American sanctions against Syria, Iran, and Cuba. It almost looks as if HSBC set up its American affiliates in order to help a bunch of seedy dictators and terrorists get around U.S. Treasury restrictions on access to dollars.
Ian, I hate to say this, I'm almost getting numb from all of the criminal behavior that has gone on Wall Street in the last 5 years. There's the SHBC hearings and scandal. There's the whole LIBOR scandal, which is an utter violation of the important trust that we need to have in the capital markets. There's the so-called Tempest in a Teapot scandal at J.P. Morgan that is $6 billion loss and counting. There's MF Global, there's Peregrine Financial, there's, Madoff, and on and on. And to say nothing of, the banks and their willingness to continue to sell mortgage-backed securities, even though they knew they were filled with toxic waste. And some of them, like Goldman Sachs, bet against the mortgage market at the same time that it continued to sell these mortgage-backed securities. I mean, I'm almost to the point where I just can't process anymore all the number of scandals and the inability of bankers to learn from their bad behavior. It's like they have no self-awareness anymore. And maybe that's why Romney is the perfect candidate for Wall Street, because like him, they have no self-awareness either, and they can't even begin to make some amends for this extraordinary wrath of bad behavior that they have inflicted upon us. And I just don't know, frankly, if there's any way out of it. Just when I think that it can't possibly be another scandal, that we cannot possibly think of something else that already hasn't already happened. You have LIBOR, you have HSBC, you have MF Global. I mean, these didn't happen in 2007. All of these things are happening now, and it's just extraordinary. You would have thought people would have learned from their bad behavior and not been so quick to repeat it.
So just in closing, do you have an explanation for this cultural shift? I mean, bankers weren't always considered crooked. They were always considered cautious, but not crooked.
Well, there's always been a lot of bad behavior on Wall Street, unfortunately. Whenever there's a lot of money involved, a lot of greed, a lot of hubris, and a regulatory environment that frankly just can't keep up with it. Human instinct, human nature is what it is. And unfortunately, if people can see a shortcut, they often will take it. I think all of, Wall Street became much more of a casino beginning in 1970 when these firms, one after another, started going public, and they substituted a partnership culture for a bonus culture, and they were encouraged to take huge risks with other people's money as opposed to taking prudent risks with their own and their partners' money. I think that's when the culture on Wall Street began to change, and now we're 42 years into that cultural change, and there's, it's no surprise that it's frankly a bit of a disaster, and it doesn't seem like there's any willingness to stop the bad behavior. I think that until once again, many people on Wall Street who make the important decisions about how to deploy capital and who to hire and fire and what business lines to be in, those people who are making the big bucks on Wall Street need to have their full net worth on the line again, just like they used to in a private partnership. And I think that would make for a lot more sensible, prudent behavior and make Wall Street serving us, the American people, as opposed to serving the people who work there.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me, as always.
Again, I've been speaking with William Cohan, author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. And his acclaimed book, House of Cards, The Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company. He began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazare Frey and J.P. Morgan Chase. And in 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazare Frey and Company. Let's take a brief station break and be back talking about the serious blows to Syria's Assad regime that may soon fall.
This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end, no safety or surprise, the end.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And it does seem that given that the president of Syria lost his defense minister, his brother-in-law, and the head of his crisis team in a suicide bombing at a meeting in the National Security Headquarters in Damascus, that's about as close a blow to the heart of the regime as you could get, isn't it?
Yes, it's very much so. We still don't know what the blast, what caused the blast. There's talk of suicide bombers. There's talk about it having been placed there by one of the drivers. And we still don't know who did it. There are two groups claiming responsibility. But whoever did it obviously got very, very close into the inner sanctum of the regime, which is should be frightening for the Assads and the people around them.
So the two groups are the Free Syrian Army and a jihadist group calling itself Lord of the Martyrs Brigade. Are they the two that you're referring to?
Yes, absolutely. Now, the Free Syrian Army is, for your listeners should know, is not an army per se. It's a series of local militias that is extraordinarily decentralized and maybe not under anybody's direct control as well.
Well, it seems, though, I mean, I know that you can't. I had somebody on from the Syrian coordinating committees yesterday, who's the English language spokesman for the local coordinating committees inside of Syria. And of course, you know, when you talk to the opposition just as much as you talk with the government, you have to be a little skeptical. But the long and the short of it is that it seems that there's still a possibility that this could have been something that the regime did. I mean, is that too paranoid and too conspiratorial? I mean, they're capable of doing weird stuff, and suddenly the alacrity with which they've announced the replacement to the defense minister is pretty strange, but maybe not.
They wanted to demonstrate continuity for sure, and that's why they quickly were able to appoint a new defense minister, the general whose responsibility for going against Idlib in the north. I wouldn't put the regime... I think it is very, very paranoid to look at it in this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been reading the Arabic language newspapers from all sorts of sides, and we get this sort of thing coming out all the time. For example, there were groupings in Lebanon who actually claimed that this was done by the regime itself to put more blame on the Salafists so that the regime would be able to circle its wagons. Again, I think that that is overly paranoid. I think that the regime took quite a hit today, and I don't think that the regime would have done this to itself.
And the fact that... The fact that General Asaf Shawkat, who's married to Assad's sister Bushra, didn't he get into a family squabble and one of the, I think it was Assad's brother that died, shot him in the stomach some time back? Do you know that story?
Yes. This was supposed to have taken place at a family meal. The Assads themselves weren't particularly enamored by Shawkat when he first entered into their lives. He came from a fairly middling background. He wasn't the sort of person that they wanted to have in their lives. And there were rumors that he was going to marry Bushra or propose to Bushra for the money and for the access. But what's happened subsequent to that is that he has proved to be probably the key player in the national security team. He is the deputy defense minister. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but he actually had far more power than the defense minister had. He was the person who was overseeing the military intelligence services. And for those of you who know anything about Syria, particularly the Air Force intelligence is considered to be probably the most powerful and the most vicious of the intelligence services. If you remember back to the murder of the boy, Hamza Khatib, for example, that was Air Force intelligence that was responsible for that. Remember, Hafez al-Assad himself came out of the Air Force.
And, of course, that incident with the boy in many ways propelled this this revolution against, or this what now the Red Cross is now describing as a civil war. Again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA, who's a specialist on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria. His latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. The White House today came out with a statement, James, saying it's clear that the Assad regime is losing control of Syria. There is real momentum against Assad with increasing defections and a strengthened and more united opposition that is operating across the country. I guess no great revelations there, but they've been saying for some time that Assad's going to go, right?
Yeah, they have. At a certain point, Hillary Clinton predicted a coup d'etat. That's more wishful thinking than sound foreign policy analysis, actually. I very much appreciate your playing Jim Morrison before this segment, that this is the end, but I'm not quite sure that we can, at this point, kiss goodbye to the Assad regime, and there's several reasons for that. The opposition is not united, as the Obama administration says. It's highly factionalized. There are groupings within it that hate other groupings within it. In addition to that, just as the events of today might cause people to reassess their commitment to the Assad regime, it also might force people to circle the wagons who are committed to the Assad regime as well. They are very, very scared at this point, very worried about what's going to happen. They are not going to survive a opposition victory, and they know this. And this brings me to the third point, that in spite of the fact that the opposition has been getting more and more defectors and deserters into its ranks, the army and or the military in Syria has not yet unleashed what it is capable of doing. As vicious as it has been in putting down the opposition, they have not, for example, used multiple launch missiles. They have not used, for example, fixed-wing aircraft, et cetera, et cetera. The reason for that is because they know that there is a line which, if they cross, means that a Libya scenario would be very, very likely, that outside forces are very likely to intervene. So they've been very careful not to cross that line. What this means, of course, now is the fact that rather than go down and go down hard, what they will do is cross that line, be willing to sacrifice it all on one last throw of the dice.
So the spokesperson for the Syrian coordinating committees inside of Syria, the opposition people that I spoke with yesterday, said that I said that my understanding of this has been 13,000 defections from the Syrian army. She said that's up to 40,000. There's no question Western and Israeli intelligence officials have said that the Assad government appears to be quietly shifting some of its chemical weapons from storage sites. So just two questions. One is, and by the way, that they've also moved troops from the Golan Heights. That's what the Israeli defense minister has said, or the chiefs of staff, I should say. So there's indications that Syria, the Alawite core, may be diminished. If there's so many defections and so many of the military are locked in their barracks because they can't trust them to go out and give them guns, what do you think is happening on that front? And then secondly, the chemical weapons question.
Okay, first of all, on the military question, you have to understand that there are anywhere between 100 and 200,000 absolutely loyal troops. And these people are better prepared, they're better equipped than the basically the draftees who are in the Free Syrian Army right now. Many of whom, by the way, most of whom, actually defected without weapons of any sort. They've been able to get weapons through smuggling. They've been able to get weapons from actually buying them from soldiers who are still on the job. But for the most part, they have absolutely no heavy weapons whatsoever. I mean, so there's that. In addition to that, the Syrian regime doesn't just rely on the military. If you've been following, again, the what's been going on, they've been outsourcing a lot of the violence. In other words, of course, what you would have is military units shelling, for example, districts within Homs or Hama or whatever. But to go and clean up these areas, what they do is they send in a group called the Ashbah, ghosts. These are thugs, smugglers, pimps, drug runners, et cetera, et cetera.
Prison guards, I believe, yeah.
Absolutely. They are the ones that the regime counts on for absolute loyalty, because these people come from the districts around Latakia, where Hafez al-Assad came from, and, of course, his son as well. And they are also Alawite. Now, these people are fiercely loyal for one reason, because they realize that they're the first ones who are going to die if the opposition takes over.
So they're the ones that are doing all the killing, and the Shabiha, I guess, is another way they're described by the guy.
And right, it should be a singular, Ashbah is plural. But
oh, I see. Well, I'm not the expert here.
Okay.
I did talk the other day, by the way, to a Amnesty International monitor who snuck into Syria and witnessed atrocities and documented them following the Syrian army in 23 villages. And she said that she was told that they cram prisoners into a 5 by 4 meter room, about 120 people are pressed in like sardines, and then they take them out for torturing, and some of them don't come back, and those that do come back say that they couldn't go back again. They'd rather die than be tortured again. And it leads you to the question of how many people have actually died. The official figure of 16,000 is low compared to, if you factor in the number of people that have been 100,000 plus that have been taken into the prison system, 50,000 missing. It's got to be much higher than 16,000, right?
Right, plus the huge number of refugees that are in various places, Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, et cetera, as well. We don't really know. But the other thing is that we should also realize that the regime commits enormous atrocities, but those atrocities are not limited to the regime. The opposition as well has committed atrocities against those people that it perceives to be either fighting for the regime or being collaborators. Extrajudicial executions, for example, is something that they've been involved in. There's rumors of massacres. Again, we don't really know who is telling the truth here in terms of whether or not each side accuses the other of committing atrocities. But I think we should be very, very careful before we begin to look at the opposition now as the sort of opposition that we saw in places like Tunisia and Egypt. The social networking kids.
Sure. Obviously, things are moving quickly, and I'm reminded of the fact that the historical examples like Ceausescu and all the way through to Gaddafi, when things start to unravel, it happens a lot quicker than people predict. So we could
be. I was actually in Syria in 1989. And the thing that was very interesting about Syria in 1989 was they weren't saying, could Czechoslovakia happen here? Could Hungary happen here? They all said, could Romania, could Ceausescu happen here?
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about China's princelings. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Susan Shirk, who's the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Ho Mi Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened the Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Shirk.
Well, it's nice to be back with you.
And the New York Times has a front page story today that's kind of intriguing. It starts out by talking about a meeting that took place last October, a big banquet in Beijing's tallest skyscraper, attended by the son of Mao Zedong's immediate successor, the daughter of the country's number two military official, who's been in there for some time, three decades, and then the half-sister of China's president-in-waiting, and many more. So what are the princelings up to?
Well, there's a very lively debate underway in China now about its future, right on the eve of the leadership turnover at the 18th Party Congress, which is going to occur this fall. And the princelings, the so-called princelings, the sons and daughters of the leaders of the Chinese Revolution and high-level political leaders, are pretty worried about China's future. So they, along with other people who are not so privileged, are debating where should China go from here, whither China.
So what's the dynamics in this debate? The princelings clearly have a lot of privilege. That goes without saying. So it would seem that they're conflicted. On the one hand, they want to maintain their privileges, which indicate a enormous disparity in wealth in this emerging number two economy in the world. But on the other hand, is there some of them that have a conscience, some altruism perhaps? What's going on there?
Well, you're right that their wealth and their influence of them and their families is completely bound up with the survival of Chinese Communist Party rule. And the way it looks to them now, it looks pretty shaky. And I must say there are many Chinese friends and colleagues in the last 6 or 12 months who've just volunteered to me that they really are worried that the days of the CCP rule in China are numbered. So I think what they would like to see is they'd like to see more active efforts on the part of the next administration in China to introduce political reforms from above, because they worry that if there's no strengthening of the legal system or no way that private enterprise can compete with the state-owned enterprises and other problems in the economic system, that they're kind of reaching the end of the road for Communist Party rule, that there's a lot of social discontent. It's harder and harder to maintain unity among the leaders at the top. And, they're worried that the whole house of cards could collapse. So then there's a debate over what to do about it. And I think most of the people who are quoted in this article are pro-reform people who'd like to see more active reforms be introduced.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who's the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and was formerly the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. And her latest book is Changing Media, Changing China. Now, when Chinese officials tell you that they're worried about the party collapsing, I mean, that also, of course, is somewhat self-serving. Why is there an assumption that the collapse of the party would result in chaos? Because my understanding is that there's an internal struggling going on and has been for some time between the government and efforts to bring about civil society and a legal system. You have these two parallel governments, if you will, the Communist Party on the one hand and a nascent kind of Chinese government on the other. And if the corrupt one goes away, that doesn't mean that the embryonic one is not going to take its place.
Well, the problem is that the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao administration for the past 10 years has really not done anything very significant. That's an exaggeration. But basically, the efforts that had occurred before to try to strengthen civil society, to improve governance, to allow more of an opening to the media, for the media, and journalist oversight of government, legal system, build rule of law, it's all been stalled out. And what has happened instead is the vested interests of the state-owned enterprises, the propaganda department, the internal security bureaucracies, they have basically been a roadblock, and they've convinced the leaders that any opening, any greater accountability or giving more voice to civil society, that once you go down that road, it's a slippery slope and you'll lose control over society.
But isn't it fair to say, Susan Shirk, that the party itself is often corrupt and capricious, and we just have witnessed the fall of Bo Jilai, in a very spectacular fall of a Politburo member. Now, whether or not that's an indicator of things to come, I don't know. But
well, yeah, I think that shows a couple of things. One is it shows how it's increasingly difficult for the top leaders, these nine men in the Standing Committee of the Politburo in particular, to maintain a facade of unity. They're in competition with one another, yet they try to make it look to everyone outside as if they're in complete lockstep agreement on everything. The Bo Jilai case is an example of how one ambitious leader, by going public, can really threaten the whole system. So their problem is, how do you maintain this unity at the top and prevent people from going public, even though in this new media environment, it's just so easy for a leader to go public and try to build a public following. The other thing, of course, it shows is that corruption is very pervasive. Bo Jilai is not the only leader with problems in his family and with a lot of corruption, and everybody knows that. But again, how in this non-democratic, hierarchical, authoritarian system do you prevent corruption? How do you, if they go after one another for corrupt behavior, it becomes war of all against all. And again, it reveals the divisions at the top, which could be suicidal. So they're stuck because of the nature of their political institutions. There's no way to throw the rascals out through elections. The legal system is just a tool of the party. There's no independent legal system, so corruption gets worse and worse.
So how do you reconcile then the pervasive belief amongst most Chinese that the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China lifted hundreds of millions of citizens from poverty and created this huge urbanized middle class, and it's all around them. You just have to look at the skyline. But at the same time, this is the most, they even have a worse disparity of wealth than we do in the United States.
That's
and
right.
Many people consider what we're going through here in the United States with the 1% versus the 99% a new gilded age. Apparently, it's even worse in China. So I don't know how you can reconcile those two facts.
I know. It sounds really contradictory, doesn't it? I think the explanation is that Deng Xiaoping, who was China's leader in the 1980s, boldly transformed China's economic system and liberated all of this entrepreneurial and creative energy of the Chinese people, lifted residence controls so that rural people could move to the cities, opened the economy to the world economy, invited in foreign investment. China took off in the most dramatic way, and it was largely by decentralization of power and incentives. But beginning in the late 90s, especially after 2000, you've really seen something of a reversal with the building up of the state sector, state-led growth. I mean, they haven't gone back to central planning, but they are favoring these big state-owned enterprises, which are monopolistic, and it's very hard for private businesses to get bank credit. The stimulus after the global financial crisis very much aggravated the problem because most of that huge stimulus went to the state sector. They stopped the progress that was being made to create an independent legal system. So things have, from the standpoint of these princelings who are worried about the future and a lot of other white-collar people in China, they really think that things have kind of gone backward. But that doesn't mean that Chinese society is seething with unrest. Most people are quite satisfied with the improvement in their living standards. You know, they're unhappy about corruption. They're unhappy about inequality. They'd like a little more voice. But it's not a revolutionary situation, in fact. But over time, it could become one.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, and her latest book is Changing Media, Changing China. Now, the political successor to President Hu Jintao is Xi Jinping. Again, it's pretty opaque, isn't it? Nobody knows who this guy is and what makes him tick, but on the other hand, it usually doesn't matter, right?
Well, he definitely is holding his cards very close to his chest because he can only lose by making enemies or being too outspoken at this point because he is the anointed successor. If you say he doesn't matter that much because it's collective leadership, yes, to a certain extent that's true. He's only first among equals in this collective rule of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, but he is first. You know, he does have the authority, especially over personnel appointments. He certainly has the ability to shape the overall direction for China. If he wanted to take some bold initiatives, you know, he might, I don't know whether or not he'd be able to bring his colleagues on board. It really depends what's in their minds, and everybody's been quite cautious. But I think there's an opening. There's a possibility for some positive new initiatives in the next administration. And I want to mention one thing. I think the low-hanging fruit here is the legal system. I mean, strengthening the legal system, even if you don't do anything about elections, would mean a dramatic improvement in fairness and justice, and it would make the economy work better. And I was encouraged that the party leaders, when they brought down Bo Xilai, said, tried to make the best of it, and said, look, this shows that we are a party ruled by law. No one, even very powerful leaders, are above the law. And I thought there was some hint that they might be moving in the direction of trying to strengthen the legal system.
So, well, just in closing, it's fair to say we've been largely talking about a top-down movement towards any possible reform as opposed to a bottom-up. So is that to say that the spirit of 1989, the Tiananmen, that's dead? There's no chance of a reform movement coming from the people?
Well, you know, we haven't talked yet about the microblogs and the Chinese Twitter called Weibo. There is a lot of discussion among ordinary people about all of these issues as well, and quite open. I mean, the debate about China's future is much more open than we've ever seen it before, in large part because of these social media. And but the ability to bring about change bottom up in China, in a society where you can still send the police to repress anyone who's seen to be creating an organized opposition, it's still pretty daunting. So there are protests about very local specific issues. But I think that if and when change comes in China, it's more likely to come from the top.
Well, just to go back, though, to the scandals that took down the Politburo member, Bo Xilai, and what came out of that, you know, with the whole soap opera involving the British businessman who was murdered by Bo Xilai's wife or on orders from him, and the idea of his corrupt friend, the police chief, and it's a window into this kind of unholy relationship between powerful politicians and powerful businessmen. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these businessmen have done well in China, have come from Taiwan. I'm just trying to get a sense of how that would compare, for example, to the way that Russia works under KGB Incorporated, the Putin regime, where Putin seems to regulate the capitalists. I don't know whether he shakes them down, but he certainly gives all of the big state enterprises to his cronies, and perhaps he's going to end up incredibly wealthy at the end of his tenure, which mercifully may end sooner than, at least according to my friends in Russia, who find the reversal of democracy frightening. Is there a comparison then between the way KGB Incorporated operates in Russia and the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China operates in terms of its relationship to the business titans?
I think there's some similarity, but there are also a lot of differences. China's, the firms in Russia are private firms. And they're private firms that are very dependent on the patronage of Putin and the central government. And if they challenge that, they're in trouble.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you very much for joining us here today, Susan Cheung.
Well, it's always good to talk with you. You're very knowledgeable, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Susan Cheung, the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, and the Ho Mui Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened Its Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, assistant producer Brooke Peterson. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down.